The year is 1997. New York City is a maximum security prison. The president has crash-landed in the middle of it, and the only man who can save him doesn't give a damn. Ladies and gentlemen, strap on your eye patches, light up a cigarette you don't even want, and growl every sentence like you've got a throat full of gravel, because tonight we are talking about Escape from New York, the movie that taught us all that the future is a lawless, leather-clad wasteland, and that the coolest guy in the room is always the one who says the least. Kurt Russell, icon, John Carpenter, legend, Snake Plissken, the blueprint for every anti-hero that came after. If you don't love this movie, I don't trust you. And if you think Escape from L.A. is better, I will physically fight you in a wrestling ring while Oxbaker swings a spiked bat at my head. So, let's get into it, because time is running out, and I'm pretty sure my head is about to explode if I don't yell about this movie right now.
New York, 1997. The entire city is a walled maximum security prison. The bridges are mined. The rivers are patrolled. And the United States Police Force has everything under control, they think.
I'm going in.
John Carpenter's Escape from New York, the high adventure of the future. One man must go in where no man has ever gotten out. And if he comes back alone, his nightmare has just begun.
Who are you?
John Carpenter's Escape from New York.
Heard you were dead.
John Carpenter's Escape from New York, the greatest escape of them all, is about to blow the future apart.
Okay, people, grab your eye patches, light up a cigarette, and prepare to stare down authority with absolute contempt, because tonight we are talking about Escape from New York, a movie that is cooler than you, meaner than you, and absolutely does not care about your feelings. This is the film that made Kurt Russell a certified action legend, turned dystopian futures into a vibe, and gave us a one-man army who wants nothing to do with saving the world, but does it anyway, just to be spiteful. All right, before we dive headfirst into this dystopian masterpiece, let's introduce the crew. With me tonight, first up, he's our resident film nerd, a deep dive research machine, and the guy who will absolutely go on a 20-minute rant about how Escape from New York is way smarter than people give it credit for. It's Jeff.
You know I will, and I stand by it.
And producing this madness, watching this for the first time, and still processing why the President of the United States has a full British accent, it's producer Steve.
I'm just saying, we had American actors. Why is he British?
That's right. Steve's fresh off his first trip to Carpenter's vision of 1997, and we are going to unpack that. Buckle up, folks. This is Escape from New York. All right. Before we get into the nitty-gritty details, I just got to say, this movie, this stupid, brilliant, ridiculous, perfect movie, it means something to me.
By the way, nobody thinks Escape from LA is better.
Wait, are there people who actually think that?
Yes, Steve, and I will fight them in a wrestling ring while Oxbaker swings a spiked bat at my head.
Yeah, okay, but those people are wrong.
Just making sure we're all on the same page. Anyway, like I was saying, this movie means something to me. I first saw Escape from New York when I was way too young to understand half of it. But I knew that Snake Plissken was the coolest character I had ever seen. He didn't talk unless he had to. He didn't take orders. He didn't care about the mission. And somehow, that made him the most dangerous guy in the room. This was one of those movies that just stuck with me. The music, the atmosphere, the fact that the world was so broken, but nobody was even trying to fix it anymore. And then you have Snake, this guy who's been chewed up and spit out by the system, and his entire energy is just, fine, I'll do it. But I'm going to be an asshole about it. And you know what? That's beautiful. It's the anti-authority, screw the government movie. And it's done in such a cool way. No preachy speeches, no exposition dumps, just vibes. Just a guy who walks in, does the job, and then screws over the people in charge just because he can. And I love that. I love everything about it.
For me, it's a little different. I came to this movie later. When I first saw it, I thought, okay, this is cool, but is there more to it? And the more I watched, the more I realized, yes, there is. It's not just a fun action movie. It's a John Carpenter movie, and that means it's layered. It's a dystopian thriller, but it's also a satire. It's a Western. It's noir. It's Carpenter doing what he does best, taking a ridiculous, pulpy B-movie premise and turning it into something smarter than it looks. People talk about Blade Runner when they think about the 80s future aesthetic, but Escape from New York is just as important. It's this grimy, dirty, fire-lit vision of the future where the world didn't advance. It just rotted. And at the center of it, you've got Snake Plissken, a guy who should be the hero, but he's not. He's just done. This movie is pure attitude. It's a middle finger to authority, to government, to the idea of a righteous hero, and the fact that it still feels so cool, even now, that tells you everything you need to know about its legacy.
All right, Steve, you just watched this for the first time. What did you think?
It was fine.
Ah!
Oh, no.
I knew you were going to say that. Fine. That's it? Fine? You might as well have spit on the Statue of Liberty.
Look, I liked it. It's cool. It's got a vibe. But I also spent half the movie wondering, why was Snake the guy they sent in? Like, was there really no other option? Just this guy, this one dude with an eye patch and the personality of a wet cigarette?
That's part of the point. Snake is the last person you should send on a mission, and that's why it works.
Exactly. He's not a hero. He's not trying to be. And that is what makes him the greatest.
All right, I get it. He's cool. But I need you to explain to me why this was the role that made Kurt Russell an action star. Like, why him?
Oh, Steve, I am so glad you asked, because before Snake Plissken, before he was the blueprint for every anti-hero you love, Kurt Russell was Elvis.
And that is where we have to start, because this whole Carpenter-Russell partnership, it begins with the King.
All right, but before we move on, serious question. Is Snake Plissken the most ripped-off character of the last 40 years, or is it Han Solo?
Oh, that's a fight waiting to happen.
Okay, hold up. That is actually a really interesting debate.
Think about it. Every sarcastic, world-weary anti-hero with a cool jacket, either they're doing Han Solo or they're doing Snake. Video games, comics, action movies. Someone is always ripping one of them off.
Okay, yes, but Han Solo is a rogue with a heart of gold. He's still a hero. Snake Plissken, he does not care. He's straight up done with everything. That's a different kind of cool.
Yeah, but which one influenced more? Han Solo is basically the foundation of every charismatic scoundrel character. But Snake, he created the gritty, disillusioned loner who hates authority, but still gets dragged into saving the day.
Solid Snake from Metal Gear is literally just, what if Snake Plissken was a secret agent?
Exactly. The eye patch, the voice, the attitude. Metal Gear straight up stole Snake Plissken. Hideo Kojima doesn't even deny it.
All right, all right. Solid Snake, really? That's where we are going. Let's put it this way. Han Solo wins in terms of mainstream impact. But if you're talking about the DNA of modern action heroes, the whole gruff loner who reluctantly saves the day, that's Snake's territory.
Okay, fair. But if Han Solo and Snake Plissken got in a fight...
Snake wins. No debate. Han Solo needs a crew. Snake just needs a cigarette. And 20 minutes.
All right. Before Adam goes full conspiracy board on why Snake Plissken should be in every movie, let's get into how this thing actually got made, why the studio hated the idea, how they filmed a futuristic dystopia on a tiny budget, and why Kurt Russell had to fight to even get this role.
Call me Snake.
All right. So, before we even get into the movie itself, we got to talk about how we got here. Because this isn't just a John Carpenter had an idea and made a movie situation. No, no, no. This is a partnership, a meeting of minds. The beginning of a beautiful cinematic bromance.
And that all starts with Elvis, because believe it or not, before Kurt Russell was Snake Plissken, before he was Jack Burton, before he was blowing up alien monsters in The Thing, he was the king himself.
Like, Elvis Elvis?
Elvis Elvis.
Back in 1979, John Carpenter directed a TV movie called Elvis, and Kurt Russell played the lead. And this was a big deal for Russell, because up until then, he was still seen as a Disney kid. You know, the computer wore tennis shoes, that darn cat, all that stuff. And he crushed it. Even got nominated for an Emmy.
So you're telling me Snake Plissken moonwalked into action movie history?
Okay, first of all, Elvis didn't moonwalk, but second, yes, kind of. Elvis is what made Carpenter realize that Russell wasn't just some clean-cut kid. He had range. He had edge. And when it came time to cast Escape from New York, Carpenter didn't want some action hero stereotype. He wanted Kurt. Freaking. Russell.
Which, by the way, the studio hated at first. They wanted someone tougher. Someone like Charles Bronson or Tommy Lee Jones. But Carpenter fought for Russell. And thank God he did, because Snake Plissken wouldn't work with anyone else.
Absolutely not. Snake is Kurt Russell's character. Full stop! The raspy voice, the eye patch, the absolute vibe of a guy who cannot be bothered. That's all Russell.
Okay, but wait. Didn't Russell do some completely insane movie between Elvis and Escape?
Oh, you're talking about Used Cars.
Oh. Used Cars is nuts. And it's truly awesome. That's where Russell basically breaks out of the Disney mold for real. He plays a scumbag car salesman in this completely unhinged, R-rated comedy, and he is insane in it. Just fast-talking, dirtbag energy, lying to everyone. If you want to see pure chaotic Kurt Russell, that's the movie. Now that movie is in Rewind or Die's Future somewhere.
I can tell you're already trying to figure out when we should cover that movie, but talking about Russell, that's what made Escape from New York work. He was ready to shed that old image and become a full-on action star. He'd done the good guy roles, he'd done Elvis, he'd proven he had charisma. Now, it was time to get gritty.
So, is this like when Disney Channel stars want to break into mainstream roles? Is this what the real origin story of Snake Plissken is? Disney, Elvis, sleazy car salesman, then full badass.
I'll stop you before you compare him to Hannah Montana, but exactly, the man had range. And once he put on that eye patch, there was no going back.
And Carpenter and Russell, they clicked. This was just the beginning. They would go on to do The Thing, Big Trouble in Little China, Escape from L.A., but it starts here. This is where Kurt Russell becomes Kurt Russell.
So what you're saying is, we should actually be talking about Elvis right now.
Steve, I swear to God.
Before Adam explodes, let's move on to the next part. How Carpenter actually got this movie made, why the studio didn't trust it, and the insane places they had to film to make this world look real.
Joel Darner for Darner Chrysler Plymouth, and here is Kurt Russell starring in a film here on our lot. Let him tell you about it.
Thank you, Joe. Yes, we're shooting a picture called Used Cars for Columbia Pictures, and even we haven't got deals like this. Take this 79 Chrysler here. You get a $300 rebate directly from Chrysler, plus Darner's discount of $1,700. If you can beat it, go somewhere else. I don't think you can. The best wheels, best deals on wheels. Right, Joe?
Right. Absolutely, Kurt. That's at Darner Chrysler Plymouth.
All right. So let's talk about how this movie got made. Because it wasn't just Carpenter had an idea and everyone threw money at him. No, this was a struggle. A mix of lucky breaks, studio skepticism, and John Carpenter being just stubborn enough to push it through. First off, Carpenter originally wrote Escape from New York in 1976. And you have to understand, this was a very specific time in American history. Now, when it came out, it was the 80s, and even 1981 wasn't any better. But this was still the malaise era. This was still 70s disillusionment. Watergate had just happened. People did not trust the government. Crime was skyrocketing. And New York City? It was basically becoming the crime-ridden wasteland this movie predicts.
Yeah, this was the era of Death Wish and Ford to City Drop Dead. People thought New York was done.
Exactly. Carpenter sees this, and he comes up with this ridiculous idea. What if they just gave up on fixing crime and turned Manhattan into a prison? And the thing is, back in the 70s, that didn't sound completely insane. But when he wrote the script, nobody wanted it. It was too dark, too weird. Studios told him it was too bleak, which is hilarious, because a year later, Mad Max comes out, and suddenly, dystopian action movies are everywhere.
Thank you.
So basically, he was too ahead of the curve?
Pretty much. But then, Halloween happens. It blows up. Biggest independent horror movie ever W that point. And suddenly, Carpenter has power. So now, when he takes Escape from New York back to studios, they listen.
He's got juice!
The studio that finally bit was Avco Embassy Pictures. They were small, but they were willing to take risks. They gave Carpenter a two-picture deal, one for The Fog and one for Escape from New York.
And that budget? Tiny by action movie standards.
Oh, yeah. Carpenter only got $6 million to make this thing. For comparison, Raiders of the Lost Ark came out the same year with a $20 million budget. Carpenter was working with pocket change compared to Spielberg.
Wait. So the same year we got Indiana Jones globe-trotting through ancient temples with insane set pieces, Carpenter had to make an entire dystopian future on a quarter of that budget.
Yep. And that's why everything about Escape from New York is so resourceful. They had to cheat to make it work.
Which brings us to how they made a futuristic New York without filming in New York.
Right. So Carpenter needed the city to look completely abandoned. But good luck actually getting New York City to shut down for filming. So instead, they found the perfect alternative, East St. Louis, Illinois. Now, here's the crazy part. East St. Louis had literally been destroyed by a massive fire in 1976. Entire city blocks were just burned out shells of buildings. And Carpenter and his team, they loved it. They walked in and said, "Yep, this is our post-apocalyptic Manhattan."
So they basically found a real-life dystopia?
Pretty much. The city gave them free rein to film. They even let them shut off the power grid at night so the streets would be completely dark. That's how they got that eerie, abandoned city look without spending a dime on set construction.
That's wild. A whole city just looking like an action movie set by accident. Oh, you need a burned-out city? There just happened to be one lying around.
And then there's the way they faked all the high-tech stuff, Like, you know, the wireframe graphics that show Snake's flight path into Manhattan.
Yeah, the green grid computer stuff?
Not CGI. They couldn't afford real computer animation. So instead, they built a miniature model of New York, lined all the buildings with reflective tape, and filmed it under blacklight to make it look like computer graphics.
Okay, that's actually genius.
Right? It's straight-up movie magic. Like, today, they just slap CGI on it. But Carpenter built his way around the budget.
And then there's the 69th Street Bridge, which is supposed to be covered in landmines. That was actually the old chain of Rock's Bridge, a real abandoned bridge that had been shut down. The production bought it for $1, used it for filming, and then sold it back when they were done.
Wait. They rented a bridge for a dollar?
Yep. Cheapest set piece in movie history.
I love everything about that. Hey, can we use your bridge? Sure, it's a dollar.
That's how you make a $6 million budget feel like $20 million. Everything in this movie is stretched to its limit.
So the whole thing is basically held together with duct tape and vibes.
Ugh, vibes, but yes, pretty much. And it works because Carpenter knew exactly where to spend his money. Instead of fancy effects, he put it all into atmosphere, locations, and letting Kurt Russell be a total badass.
Which, speaking of, let's talk about how Kurt Russell got this role. Because the studio, they hated the idea. And Carpenter had to fight for his guy.
Hey, you're Snake Plissken, ain't you? What do you want?
Nothing.
I thought you were dead.
All right. So we've talked about how this movie got made, how Carpenter stretched every dollar, and how they turned a burned-down city into a dystopian nightmare. But now, let's talk about the most important part, how Kurt Russell became Snake Plissken.
And make no mistake, this wasn't an easy sell. The studio did not want Kurt Russell for this. To them, he was still the Disney guy. They wanted someone else, someone tougher, someone like...
Let me guess, Charles Bronson.
Bingo. The studio straight up pitched Bronson. But Carpenter, he knew that was a terrible idea.
Because if Bronson's in this, Snake Plissken is just Death Wish 6. Escape from New York. I don't know. I kind of want to see that movie too.
Well, exactly. And Carpenter had just worked with Russell on Elvis, which, like we talked about earlier, is where their whole relationship starts. He'd seen Russell transform into someone completely different on screen, and he knew Russell could be Snake.
But the studio didn't buy it.
Not even close. They wanted someone with an action movie resume. They even considered Tommy Lee Jones.
Wait, Tommy Lee Jones as Snake Plissken?
Dude, can you even imagine? Just grumbling his way through the whole movie? They'd have the always seeming pissed off part, right?
Ah, hell, Hawk. I don't care about no damn president. Just get me my pardon so I can go back to Texas.
Carpenter wasn't having it. He fought for Russell. But Russell also knew he had to prove himself. So what does he do? He takes on a completely unhinged role in Used Cars.
Yes. We talked about Used Cars for a second. But I want to go back because that movie is wild. Russell is just chaos personified. He's playing this fast-talking, scheming, morally bankrupt car salesman, just going for it at 100 miles an hour.
And that was on purpose. He needed to show people he wasn't just the clean-cut, all-American Disney kid. Used Cars is his career sledgehammer, the movie where he breaks out and tells Hollywood, I can be anything.
So between Used Cars and Elvis, Carpenter could go back to the studio and say, look, he's got range.
Exactly. And eventually, they gave in. They let Carpenter cast Russell. But here's the best part.
Oh, I love this part.
Russell didn't just take the role. He built Snake. He made Snake Plissken. The attitude, the body language, the eye patch, that was all him.
Wait, The eye patch was his idea?
Yep. Originally, Snake didn't have it, but Russell thought it added something, this almost mythic gunslinger vibe, and Carpenter loved it.
Because let's be real. Without the eye patch, Snake is cool. With the eye patch, he's legendary.
Okay, but wasn't it insanely hard to act with that thing on?
Oh, yeah. Russell hated wearing it. It wrecked his depth perception, made stunt work harder, and gave him headaches. But he kept it on because he knew it made Snake iconic.
That's commitment. He suffered for the cool factor.
Wait, did Kurt Russell choose to bring back the eye patch for Captain Ron?
Oh my God. Wait, I think he did.
Of course he did. You think that was an accident? Captain Ron is just Snake Plissken on vacation. It's in the Snake Plissken cinematic universe.
So what you're saying is, Snake Plissken is Captain Ron?
Look, Snake disappears after escape from L.A. Maybe he just said, screw this, and started giving boat tours.
Honestly, that makes too much sense. The name's Ron, Captain Ron, you don't like it, I don't care.
So the extra sequel we never got, it's just Captain Ron.
So in Strat of Escape from Earth, Snake did escape, straight to the Caribbean.
And that is now my headcanon.
And so, back to this movie. There's the voice.
Oh, you mean the Clint Eastwood growl?
Exactly. That was another Russell choice. He decided that Snake should talk like Clint Eastwood's Man with No Name. Low, quiet, always pissed off. And once again, Carpenter just let him run with it.
And that's why Snake works. He's not just a badass action hero. He's a Western anti-hero just thrown into a cyberpunk world.
Bingo. And that's also why he's been ripped off endlessly for 40 years.
Oh, are we back to my most ripped off character debate?
Yes, Steve. And the answer is still Snake.
Boom.
Look, we could argue Han Solo versus Snake Plissken all day. But let's just list the characters that wouldn't exist without Snake.
Solid Snake from Metal Gear, literally named after him.
Riddick from Pitch Black, pure Snake energy.
Every gruff, reluctant action hero in video games probably owes something to Snake.
Even Mad Max sequels leaned more into Snake-style anti-hero energy after this movie.
He changed the genre. Action heroes used to be clean-cut, good guys. After Snake, they're all cynical, world-weary. I hate this mission types.
So what we're saying is, without Snake Plissken, like, we don't get Wolverine, we don't get The Mandalorian, and we definitely don't get Joel from The Last of Us.
That's exactly what we're saying.
And all of that started because Carpenter believed in Russell when the studio didn't.
All right. I'll admit, that's pretty badass.
Speaking of badass, we need to talk about the actual mission. Because as much as I love this movie, we have to acknowledge that this whole plan, it's insanely stupid.
Oh, 100%. Up next, why the government's plan to rescue the president makes zero sense, and why that somehow makes this movie even better.
I don't give a fuck about your war or your president.
All right, so let's break this down. The story. The year is 1997. Crime has skyrocketed 400%. The U.S. government, in their infinite wisdom, decides the only way to handle this is to turn Manhattan into a giant maximum security prison. No guards inside, no infrastructure. Just good luck in there, criminals. Then, somehow, the president's plane gets hijacked and crash lands inside this lawless war zone. The most powerful man in the world is now in the hands of the most dangerous criminals alive. And what's the government's plan to get him back? Oh, I don't know. Maybe send in one guy with an eye patch, alone, with no backup, and just hope for the best.
No, wait, because the best part is, they don't even ask him to do it. They force him by injecting tiny bombs into his arteries and telling him, hey, buddy, you have 22 hours before your neck explodes. Good luck. So,
like, let's just take a second to really process how bad this plan is. The President of the United States is being held hostage, and instead of sending a highly trained elite strike team, which they 100% have, they pick one ex-soldier who actively hates them and is probably going to sabotage them the second he gets a chance.
Because Snake doesn't care. The entire plan relies on a guy who is so done with life that he's equally likely to kill the president himself just to make a point.
And even if he gets the president, then what? The entire island is full of violent criminals. They have no actual extraction plan. The best they can do is hope he gets back to the wall and maybe they'll drop a rope ladder.
That's another thing. Why is there only one way in and out? Did the U.S. government just forget boats exist?
Yes, Jeff, the answer is yes.
Also, who hired the guy designing Air Force One's escape pod? That thing is literally a giant pinball just bouncing around the city.
Right? They could have made it, I don't know. A helicopter? Maybe something with wings?
No, Steve. It's way funnier this way.
And let's not forget, the only reason Snake even has a chance at succeeding is because everyone else he meets just kind of helps him for no reason.
Oh, yeah. Cabby just randomly shows up with a working taxi in a city that hasn't had infrastructure in decades.
Cabby is a guy that probably just stuck around when the city turned into a prison and was like, this is fine. And his brain just happens to have a detailed map of the one bridge with landmines.
And Maggie? She's just like, sure, I'll risk my life for this guy I met 5 minutes ago.
Yeah, everyone in this movie is making insanely bad decisions, and somehow Snake still barely makes it.
But that's what makes it work. This isn't some perfectly executed mission. It's messy, it's desperate, and that's why it feels so cool.
Okay, but also, let's talk about the real reason Snake survives. He's just too pissed off to die.
That is his actual superpower, huh?
100%. He's not tactically brilliant. He's not unstoppable. He just has so much contempt for the situation that he refuses to die out of spite.
And honestly, that's relatable.
Okay. We need to talk about something. Why does the President of the United States have a fully British accent?
Ha ha! Because he's played by Donald Pleasance, and nobody cared.
Dude, it's incredible. He's supposed to be the leader of the free world, and he sounds like he just walked out of a parliamentary hearing. Like, I get that the future is a mess, but did we just hand the White House to a guy who sounds like he should be warning people about werewolves?
My fellow Americans, we must band together against the evil that lurks in the shadows.
Okay, but you know they just didn't care. Like, Carpenter was probably like, it's Donald Pleasance. He's awesome. Who's going to argue?
And they were right, because he just works. But I can't watch this without thinking, why is Dr. Loomis the president?
Oh my God, it really is just Dr. Loomis after a government promotion.
After years of hunting Michael Myers, Dr. Loomis finally realized the only way to protect the country was to become the president.
He spent 15 years warning us about pure evil. Now he's warning us about a 69th Street bridge covered in landmines.
I shot him 6 times, and now I need you to rescue me from the island of Manhattan.
Honestly, I'd watch that sequel.
Escape from Smith's Grove Sanitarium.
I would pay money for that.
All right, all right. Before we derail completely, let's get into just how stupid the government's rescue plan actually is.
Okay, fine. But the real question is, how the hell does the Duke of New York actually run this place? Because his whole operation makes zero sense.
Oh, Steve, you already know we're getting into that next.
Coming up, the Duke of New York, why his plan is also stupid, but at least he's having a good time.
All right, we need to talk about the Duke of New York.
Oh, we definitely do.
Because, what exactly is his plan?
That's the best part. He doesn't have one. He's just vibing.
I mean, technically, his plan is, step one, kidnap the president. Step two, question mark, question mark, question mark. Step three, be king of the crime world.
Yeah, but how does kidnapping the president give him power? He's already running the city. What's his endgame?
I have no idea. He has the most valuable hostage in the world, and his big strategy is parade him around the wasteland in a tiny cage on the hood of his car.
Okay, but to be fair, that car is sick as hell.
I will give him credit for the aesthetic. Dude rolls up in a Cadillac with actual chandeliers on the hood, like he's the king of post-apocalypse Vegas.
And Isaac Hayes sells it. He doesn't have a lot of dialogue, but you believe he's in charge just by the way he carries himself.
Oh, absolutely. But, like, how organized is his gang? What's their actual job? Are they running trade routes? Do they have infrastructure? Or are they just vibing in trash can armor, throwing people into wrestling rings?
I'm going to go with option C.
Yeah, there's zero evidence that he's running an actual economy here. It's just Mad Max rules. Biggest gang wins. And the Duke? He's got the most guys and the best car. That's it.
And to be fair, when you're in charge of literal lawless chaos, maybe that is all you need.
Okay, but why is everyone so scared of him? Like, he rules Manhattan. But what does that mean? Does he have territory lines? Does he tax people? Or is it just, I'm the Duke, and if you don't like it, my goons will shake hands at you menacingly?
I mean, maybe. But the real reason they fear him is that he's got the only real power in the city, ammunition. He's got guns. He's got bullets. Nobody else does.
That's a good point. You never see Snake reload? Does anyone else in this movie even have bullets?
Nope. Everyone's got pipes and crossbows. The Duke's the only guy with actual firepower.
And that's what keeps him in charge. If anyone steps out of line, boom, done. But instead of just executing Snake immediately, he decides to make him fight Oxbaker in a death match.
Look, when you're running a dystopian wasteland, entertainment is important.
I love how the Duke just delays every smart choice he could make. Like, you have Snake Plissken, the most dangerous guy in the city, and your first instinct isn't shoot him in the face. It's, let's see if he can survive Gladiator Night first.
It's classic villain arrogance. The Duke thinks he's untouchable. He thinks he's already won. That's why he toys with Snake instead of just dealing with him.
And how does that work out for him?
Oh, terribly, because the only thing worse than Snake Plissken on a mission is Snake Plissken with a personal grudge.
Exactly. That's why the second Snake gets an opening. He flips the board completely. Because once he gets pissed off, you're done.
And the Duke? He does not see it coming. He's so sure he's won.
Which makes it so satisfying when everything immediately collapses around him.
All right, but before we get into the big escape, we need to talk about the actual best part of this movie.
Which is?
The single pettiest act of revenge in action movie history.
Oh, I cannot wait to break this down.
Speaking of entertainment, what was up with that weird-ass show Snake finds Cabby at?
Oh, yeah. The bizarre post-apocalyptic cabaret.
Dude, I love that scene because it makes zero sense. Snake's out here sneaking around a literal hellscape, and then bam, he stumbles into a dinner theater performance.
Yeah, it's like total Mad Max energy outside, but inside, it's just some guy in drag singing show tunes to a bunch of criminals politely sitting at tables.
Which means at some point, the criminals of New York were like, hey, you know what we need? A night out.
Right? The whole city is a burning trash pile, but somehow these dudes are like, yeah, yeah, murder, cannibalism, total anarchy. But first, let's catch this vaudeville act.
And then you have Cabby just hanging out, like, oh, hey, Snake, welcome to the club. Want a drink?
Which is wild, because Cabby acts like this is totally normal. Like, Of course, there's a criminal Broadway show in the middle of the citywide prison.
And it raises so many questions. Who's organizing this? Are there rehearsals? Do they have an audition process?
Right? And who's in the audience? These dudes are out here like, yeah, I shanked a guy for a can of dog food today, but you know what? I need some culture.
Honestly, I respect it. Even in the worst dystopia imaginable, you gotta have a theater scene.
All right, fine. I'll admit, it's hilarious. But now I want the extended cut where we see the other shows they put on.
Tonight at the Duke's Playhouse, A Midsummer Night's Nightmare, followed by Les Miserables, But We Actually Are.
Closing out the season, Guys and Dolls and Crossbows.
I need this spinoff, Escape from New York, the musical.
You joke, but you know Carpenter would be into it.
All right. Before we get too deep into post-apocalyptic theater productions, let's get back to what really matters.
All right, so I was reading up on this movie, and apparently Escape from New York is supposedly in the same universe as Back to the Future 2. What the hell?
Oh, you found it. Welcome to the wildest fan theory out there.
Oh, yeah. Buckle up, Steve. We're about to take a time-traveling DeLorean straight into dystopian nightmare America.
Okay, explain this to me, because Back to the Future 2 is like campy, over the top 2015, and Escape from New York is everything is on fire 1997. How does this work?
All right, so you remember Biff's Hell Valley timeline in Back to the Future 2? The one where he's taken over the city, crime is rampant, everything is corrupt, and it's basically a lawless dystopia?
Yeah.
Now imagine that timeline. Alternate 1985, but advance it ahead to 1997. So instead of just Hill Valley being a crime-infested nightmare, that chaos spreads nationwide. The government can't handle it, so instead of fixing things, they just start turning entire cities into prisons.
Exactly. The theory goes that Biff's corrupt, violent world in Back to the Future 2 eventually spirals so far out of control that by 1997, the government gives up on Manhattan completely and turns it into a maximum security prison.
Wait! So you're telling me Biff Tannen accidentally led to Snake Plissken?
Biff Tannen didn't just ruin Hill Valley. He ruined America.
And here's where it gets even weirder. You remember how the president in Escape from New York is basically just a spineless, corrupt politician who clearly doesn't care about anyone but himself?
Yeah, and?
Well, guess what? The Back to the Future 2 timeline shows that by 1985, Biff literally owns politicians. He's funding campaigns, bribing officials, controlling the police. So the theory goes, the president in Escape from New York, one of Biff's guys.
No, stop. You're telling me that Biff Tannen is the secret villain behind Escape from New York?
I mean, if Biff is funding corrupt leaders in the 80s, and by 1997, America has gone full dystopia, the timeline matches.
All right, so follow me on this. If we keep going down this timeline, then somewhere in the world of Escape from New York, Biff is still alive.
Oh my God. Imagine a Snake Plissken sequel where he has to infiltrate Biff's fortress.
Biff's running the last crime-free city in America, but it's only crime-free because he runs all the crime.
Dude, Biff's casino from Back to the Future 2 just turns into an armed compound. He's got guards, he's got weapons, and he's running America from the shadows.
Snake Plissken versus Biff Tannen. One man has a grudge, the other has a time machine. The future is screwed.
Tagline, make like a tree and die.
I can't believe I'm saying this, but I kind of need this movie.
Oh, 100%. Snake Plissken versus Biff Tannen. And the climax? Snake hijacks the DeLorean and escapes from time itself.
We gotta get Carpenter on the phone. This is gold.
Okay, but real talk. Where is Marty McFly in all of this?
Hiding, because ain't no hoverboard getting him out of this one.
So really, Any other crackpot theories you want to tie this movie into? Or are we finally done?
Oh, Jeff, we are never done. In fact, I'm just getting started.
Oh, God. Here we go.
Okay, first of all, can we talk about the fact that the government's entire plan in this movie relies on the idea that Manhattan is a prison, but nobody ever questions the fact that Manhattan is an island?
I was just about to ask, what is stopping these people from building a boat and leaving?
The government put up a wall, Steve. A wall. That's the ultimate solution to any problem.
Oh, yeah. Because criminals have never figured out water. Not once in human history.
No, you don't get it. If they just build a raft, the government has helicopters that will stop them.
Oh, right. Except for the part where Snake literally flies in on a glider and no one notices.
Yeah, that one kind of ruins the whole maximum security vibe, huh?
Sir, we have sealed off the entire island. No one can get in or out.
What about the air?
Oh, crap.
All right, so they never actually explain what Snake did to get arrested, right?
Well, officially, he tried to rob the Federal Reserve.
Oh, please. Like, that's the worst crime in America. If anything, that should have gotten him a bonus and a movie deal.
No, hear me out. What if Snake is actually in prison for the pettiest reason imaginable?
Oh, I need to hear this.
What if it wasn't a bank heist? What if Snake got arrested for something so stupid, but the government was too embarrassed to admit it, so they made up the whole Federal Reserve story?
Like unpaid parking tickets?
Yes, like Snake Plissken had too many unpaid tolls, and one day he just snapped and refused to pay. So they labeled him a threat to national security and threw him in prison forever.
Snake Plissken, victim of the DMV.
Mr. Plissken, you've accumulated $4,372 in unpaid bridge tolls.
Not my problem.
Sir, failure to pay will result in immediate incarceration in the Manhattan prison complex.
Cool.
And now he's serving life in a crime hellhole because he didn't want to pay the $15 George Washington bridge toll.
Honestly, this makes way more sense than robbing the Federal Reserve.
All right, next up, the Duke, the so-called ruler of Manhattan, the guy who has somehow united every gang in the city and controls all the crime, but also dresses like he just walked out of a Mad Max-themed Halloween party.
Dude has a cape in 1997, and he's wearing giant novelty rings on every finger.
Yeah. But it was 1997. You know what we had in real 1997? Ska.
Oh my God. The Duke of New York in a checkerboard suit and suspenders.
Who runs the city? Pick it up.
Escape from New York, but every time the Duke appears, there's an aggressive trumpet section.
Snake Plissken fighting his way through skanking henchmen.
Honestly, I'd watch it.
And let's not forget the chandeliers on his car.
Which, let's be real, is peak villain energy, but also absolutely useless. Like, why? Why do you need chandeliers on your car in a city with no power?
What if the Duke is just a really, really committed LARPer?
Oh no, I think you're onto something.
Think about it. Everyone else in Manhattan is dressed like regular criminals. Scrappy, thrown-together outfits, maybe some trash armor. But the Duke? He's dressed like an 80s funk band took over a Renaissance fair.
Like, imagine a guy who gets thrown into Manhattan prison and is like, you know what? I'm going to role play as a king.
And nobody wanted to argue because he just committed to the bit so hard.
All right, I'll be the Duke. Someone get me a cape. Also, I want a car with two giant chandeliers.
Boss, wouldn't headlights be more practical?
Shut up, Reginald. I am the Duke. Okay, that's it. We are officially declaring that Escape from New York makes no sense.
Oh, you're just figuring that out now.
You mean to tell me a government that walled off an entire island but forgot about gliders and boats didn't have a solid plan?
I can't do this anymore. We need to move on.
Fine. Next up, let's talk about why the government's entire plan is even dumber than we thought. All right, we have arrived at the moment the moment that cements Snake Plissken as not just a badass and not just a survivor, but a legendary agent of pure, unfiltered pettiness.
Because it's not enough for Snake to win. It's not enough for him to survive or escape or even save the president. No, no, no. He has to go one step further and make sure everyone involved in this nightmare knows exactly how little he respects them.
Okay. But explain it to me like I'm five, because I did just watch this movie and I still can't believe how cold this move is.
Gladly. So, Snake barely makes it back to the wall. He's been shot at, betrayed, nearly exploded, and forced to fight a literal pro wrestler for the amusement of psychopaths. But he does it. He gets the president out. He completes the mission.
And what does the president do? He gives him a half-assed, dismissive thank you before going off to do his big important speech to the world.
Oh, yeah. He is so done with Snake the second he's safe, like, oh, you almost died for me? Cool, buddy. Anyway, I gotta go be important now.
And you see it in Snake's face. That moment where he realizes, oh, you don't actually care about anyone who just died for you. You don't care about me. Cool. Cool, cool, cool. And then, without missing a beat, he switches out the president's tape.
That's right. The one thing the president actually needs, the speech that's supposed to save the world, Snake swaps it with random jazz music.
That's next level spite. Like, he could have just walked away. He could have just said nothing. But no, he makes sure that when the whole world is watching, the president gets publicly humiliated.
It's so perfect because it's not some big speech about justice or getting even. Snake doesn't say anything. He doesn't need to. He just lights a cigarette, walks away, and pulls the literal plug on the system.
And the best part? The president doesn't even notice at first. He just starts giving this super serious speech, and then, bam, smooth jazz. The whole world just gets a guy scatting on a saxophone instead of a nuclear peace treaty.
That's so much worse than if Snake had just destroyed the tape. Because now the whole world thinks the president is an idiot.
That's what makes it art. Snake doesn't just ruin the plan. He makes sure everyone sees it happen.
It's the most petty screw you in action movie history. No explosions, no final battle. Just one tiny act of revenge that ruins everything for the people in charge.
So let me get this straight. Snake's actual final mission in this movie isn't to save the president. It's to make the most powerful man in the world look like an absolute clown on live TV.
Correct?
Respect?
Honestly, same. It's one of the coolest, pettiest, most badass endings of all time. No monologues, no big moment. Just a silent smirking, screw you.
That's what you get for putting your all-important plan on a tape.
Ha ha! Right? Like, this is 1997. We had CDs. Maybe put your nuclear peace treaty on something that can't be swapped out with smooth jazz.
What, you think in actual 1997 Bill Clinton kept all his plans on a CD?
I mean, probably not. But I guarantee he didn't put the fate of the world on a cassette tape.
Right? Like, I'm pretty sure even in the 90s, national security briefings weren't stored on the same format as my dad's road trip mixtape.
That's what I'm saying. You're the president. You can't put your one chance at world peace on a thing that can be eaten by a car stereo.
Also, why is there only one copy? You're telling me the entire Global Peace Initiative is just one tape rolling around in the president's pocket.
That's why Snake's revenge is so funny. He doesn't even have to destroy it. He just swaps it out. And suddenly, the most powerful man in the world is completely screwed.
That's next level incompetence. You got all of America's security forces, and you still got outplayed by a guy with an eye patch and a grudge.
Moral of the story, don't trust outdated technology. And definitely don't piss off Snake Plissken.
What you think the president should actually look down at the tape and say, wait, this tape says best of Kenny G. This isn't my plan.
Oh, God. Snake Plissken stole my foreign policy and gave me smooth jazz.
Honestly, that's a fate worse than death.
Snake didn't just sabotage the president. He made sure he had to listen to it. And that, my friends, is why Snake Plissken is one of the greatest action heroes of all time.
All right, I get it now. He earned that eye patch.
So we all agree? This movie has to go into the Rewind or Die Hall of Fame?
Oh, 100%. It's a pillar of the Hall of Fame.
I have some serious questions about this Hall of Fame's architecture. But for this movie, I can't even argue it. Snake's final move alone gets it in.
All right, so it's official. But next episode, we're talking about the other Carpenter-Russell classic. Because if you thought Snake Plissken was a badass, wait until we talk about The Thing.
Oh, I cannot wait. Paranoia, body horror, insane practical effects. It's Carpenter at his best.
Great, so instead of guy with an eye patch screws over the government, now it's guy with a flamethrower screams at aliens?
Oh, it's so much more than that. And it rules. Wait, we can't move on until we do this. Welcome to the John Carpenter Trivia Spectacular, the segment where we talk about the master of horror, synth, and not giving a single damn, and how Hollywood repeatedly fumbled the bag by not letting him direct movies that he absolutely should have. If you've ever wondered what could have been, this is for you. Let's go.
I'm already extremely tired.
I feel like I need protective gear for this one.
True or false? Carpenter was originally hired to direct Firestarter. Yes, the one with Drew Barrymore. But got fired after The Thing flopped.
Oh, this has to be true. Because studios love panicking for no reason.
Yep, true. Carpenter was locked in to direct Firestarter. But when The Thing bombed at the box office, the studio panicked and fired him. Instead, they gave it to Mark L. Lester, the guy who directed Commando.
Future Rewind or Die First Ballot Hall of Famer, by the way.
And it was so boring that even Stephen King himself hated it.
Imagine getting fired from a movie and then watching the final product suck so bad that the author of the book publicly trashes it.
Stephen King was probably like, wow, maybe the dude who made Halloween knew what he was doing.
True or false, Carpenter was offered Fatal Attraction and turned it down because he thought the script was dumb.
Oh, this has to be true. No way Carpenter wanted to direct a yuppie cheating movie.
True. The studio offered it to him, and he basically said, this sucks. Get out of my face. So they gave it to Adrian Lyne, who turned it into a massive hit.
Imagine John Carpenter making a psychological thriller where the scary thing is just some lady who won't take no for an answer.
He was probably like, where are the ghosts? Where's the alien goo? Where's the flamethrowers? This is just some dude ruining his own life.
True or false? Chevy Chase was almost cast as the president in Escape from New York.
Oh, please be false. I can't handle that mental image.
Sorry, but it's true. Carpenter considered casting Chevy Chase as the president, but ultimately went with Donald Pleasance. You know, the guy who played Dr. Loomis in Halloween.
Imagine Snake Plissken rescuing a wisecracking Chevy Chase who spends the whole time making snarky comments about the state of the prison city.
Oh, great. I'm being saved by a guy with an eye patch. This should end well.
Honestly, Snake might have just left him there out of sheer annoyance.
All right, true or false, Carpenter made Big Trouble in Little China as a giant middle finger to Hollywood after they wouldn't let him direct an Indiana Jones movie.
That would be funny, but it's false. Raiders of the Lost Ark was always a Spielberg and Lucas project. They never seriously considered anyone else.
Yeah, Spielberg and Lucas were making that no matter what. It wasn't up for grabs. Carpenter probably never even got a phone call.
Oh, well, that's disappointing.
You're just mad you can't build a revenge narrative around it.
I mean, yeah. But I'm still saying Jack Burton is just a parody of Indiana Jones.
That part? Probably true.
Next up, true or false? John Carpenter was approached to direct Top Gun and turned it down.
Oh, this has to be false. There's no way that's real.
Nope. True. Carpenter was approached, but he thought the whole thing was too much military propaganda and wasn't interested. Instead, the studio gave it to Tony Scott, who shot it like a two-hour Navy recruitment commercial and made $1 billion.
So we could have had a synth-heavy, sweaty, paranoia-fueled, haunted fighter jet movie, and instead we got a movie where Tom Cruise plays volleyball for no reason.
Okay, okay, but we all love Top Gun, right? Like, we're joking, but that movie rules.
Oh, 100%. We're not knocking Top Gun. Tony Scott knew exactly what he was doing. He didn't just make a hit, he made a cultural phenomenon.
Right. If you can direct a movie that convinces an entire generation to sign up for the Navy just so they can wear aviators and play beach volleyball, you've won.
Tony Scott had the craziest style. The man directed like he was on fire and refused to slow down.
And honestly, Top Gun is the least insane thing he made. Have you seen Domino? That movie is like getting slapped in the face with pure adrenaline.
Look, if we're talking Tony Scott appreciation, we gotta mention True Romance. That movie goes so hard, it makes you wanna rob a guy just for the cinematic experience.
And Crimson Tide. The man made a submarine movie feel like a war epic.
Honestly, if Carpenter didn't do Top Gun, Tony Scott was the only other right choice.
I'm just saying, if Carpenter did it, we'd have gotten a creepy fighter jet movie where Maverick is haunted by the ghost of his father and Goose is possibly a government experiment.
Which would have been incredible. But also, I'm glad we got the Tony Scott version.
Agreed. Top Gun stays untouched. Carpenter can keep his synth nightmares to himself.
Look, we love Tony Scott. We love Ridley Scott. But let's be real, nobody, and I mean nobody, is cooler than John Carpenter.
Oh, not even close. Dude wears sunglasses indoors, chain smokes, and only speaks in the most unimpressed sentences ever.
Carpenter gives off grumpy old guy who doesn't care if you like his movies or not energy, and it's the best.
Hollywood keeps trying to outcool Carpenter, and Carpenter keeps not caring, and that's why he's the coolest.
He literally wakes up, plays video games, ignores studio calls, and collects royalty checks. That's what winning looks like.
Meanwhile, every other director is out here desperately trying to stay relevant, and Carpenter is just like, nah, I'm good.
He's basically Snake Plissken in real life, just permanently done with everyone.
And that is why nobody outcools John Carpenter. Not now, not ever.
And to cap this all off, here's the most important, true or false of them all. John Carpenter would rather play video games than make another movie.
Oh, true. No question.
Absolutely true. Carpenter basically wakes up, plays Xbox for 10 hours, and occasionally says, Hollywood sucks.
He is living the dream. Just vibing, collecting royalty checks, and ignoring studio executives.
I aspire to this level of leave-me-alone energy.
All right, let's wrap this up before Adam finds a way to connect Escape from New York to Seinfeld.
Oh, wait, I can...
No, wait. Before we move on, the prison was only Manhattan, right?
Yeah, the rest of the country just gave up on it and walled it off.
Okay, so then what are the other boroughs like?
Oh my God, I never even thought about that. What the hell is going on in Brooklyn?
Is Brooklyn gentrified? Like, is there a Starbucks right across the bridge while Snake is getting stabbed by sewer mutants?
I mean, look, this is a future where the government just dumps criminals into Manhattan and calls it a day. So yeah, I fully believe Williamsburg is still full of hipsters drinking overpriced coffee.
Meanwhile, Queens is just normal. People are going to work. Kids are riding bikes, and every once in a while, some guy looks across the East River and goes, huh, sure is loud over there.
Okay, but what about baseball? Are the Yankees and Mets still playing?
Well, the Mets play in Queens, so they're probably fine, but the Yankees, they play in the Bronx, and knowing them, they absolutely got military funding.
100%. The Yankees survived. Their stadium probably has missile defense systems and a retractable dome made of titanium.
Due to ongoing gang warfare, tonight's Yankees game has been moved to an undisclosed underground bunker.
Meanwhile, the Mets got left to die. Shea Stadium is now just a giant open-air war zone.
Mets management would like to remind fans that all attendees must bring their own weapons and wear body armor in the bleachers.
Tonight's game is delayed due to landmine maintenance in left field.
And somehow, they're still in third place.
Okay, but real question. Is this the same universe as the Warriors?
Oh my God, it fits. The Warriors was 1979. Escape from New York is 1997. The gang wars got so out of hand that the government just said, screw it, wall it off.
So, you're telling me the baseball furies got too powerful and now Manhattan is a prison?
Yes, they started as a gimmick gang, but by 97, they're an army.
And the Duke of New York? Probably just some low-level gang leader in the Warriors who climbed the ranks.
So, escape from New York is just what happens when the gang war never stopped?
Exactly. The baseball furies took over Yankee Stadium and declared it their kingdom.
And the Mets? They never stood a chance.
Okay. But if the Warriors fits, what about Chud?
Oh my God. The Chuds are 100% canon in this universe.
Right. While Snake is running around on the surface, there's an entire underground war happening with mutant sewer people.
Honestly, this explains so much. Like, why doesn't the Duke have more people? Because half his gang got dragged into a sewer and eaten.
Meanwhile, Snake's dodging landmines, but underneath him, some guy is getting dragged into a subway tunnel by glowing-eyed cannibals.
So, the government didn't just wall off Manhattan. They also let it become an open-air feeding ground for sewer monsters.
Yes, and they didn't tell anyone. They just let it happen.
Hey, we could send in the military. Or, hear me out. Just throw some walls around it and pretend it's not happening.
And somehow the Yankees are still getting military funding? Wait. Hold on, didn't The King of Queens come out around 1997?
Oh my God, it did!
Okay, so let me get this straight. Just across the river, Doug Heffernan is griping about his job, while Snake Plissken is fighting for his life.
Doug's over here like, ugh, my boss sucks. Meanwhile, across the bridge, Snake is in a death match with Ox Baker.
Carrie's complaining about their mortgage while the president is being held hostage in a burned-out Broadway theater.
Arthur Spooner is probably yelling at the news like, in my day, we didn't turn entire cities into prisons.
This changes everything. Is Doug Heffernan canon in the Escape from New York universe?
Yes, and I need a deleted scene where Snake stops at Cooper's in Queens, and Kevin James just stares at him.
Doug's just like, hey buddy, you look like you had a rough day. And Snake just glares at him and keeps walking.
Tough commute? Yeah. Almost got eaten by sewer mutants. And I think we all know way too much about that show.
It's a quality show. But yeah, he'd be all, oh yeah, that'll ruin your evening. You want a beer?
Snake Plissken and Kevin James in a buddy cop movie. Let's go.
Captain Ron 2.
So we've talked about how this movie got made, how Kurt Russell became Snake, how the government's plan was stupid as hell, and how Snake Plissken delivered the pettiest revenge move in history. But now we have to ask, what came after? What's the legacy of Escape from New York?
Short answer, it changed everything. This movie was a blueprint for how action movies evolved in the 80s and 90s. Before this, action heroes were clean-cut, do-the-right-thing types. After Escape from New York, every major action hero started looking and acting like Snake.
So basically, if you see a dude in a leather jacket with a bad attitude, grumbling through a mission he doesn't want to do, you can thank Snake Plissken for that?
Exactly. Before this, action heroes were John Wayne. They were Superman. After this, We get every reluctant, world-weary, anti-establishment action hero ever.
Think about it. After Escape from New York, you start seeing darker action movies. Instead of just Hero Saves the Day, we get Mad Max, The Road Warrior in 81. We get The Terminator in 84. We get RoboCop, Die Hard, Lethal Weapon. All of these movies feature protagonists who are flawed, cynical, and don't give a damn about the system.
Okay, but we gotta talk about Metal Gear Solid, because Hideo Kojima straight up stole Snake.
Oh, 100%. Kojima has never been subtle about it. The main character of Metal Gear, Solid Snake, literally named after Snake Plissken.
The eye patch shows up in Metal Gear Solid 2 when he uses the alias Iroquois Plissken, which is basically just Snake Plissken with extra syllables.
Dude didn't even try to hide it.
And it worked. Solid Snake is one of the most iconic video game characters of all time. And he's just Snake Plissken with more monologues.
And it's not just games. This movie influenced comics, TV, animation. Anytime you see a gritty anti-hero with trust issues, you're seeing a little bit of Snake.
Okay. But if it was so influential, why wasn't Escape from New York a huge box office hit?
Great question. It did well. It made about $25 million on a $6 million budget, which is great for an indie movie. But it wasn't a massive blockbuster. It became a cult hit later because the people who did see it in 1981, they never stopped talking about it.
And then it got ripped off for 40 years straight.
So basically, this movie walked so every gruff anti-hero could run.
Exactly. And if that wasn't enough, Carpenter himself came back 15 years later to make a sequel.
Oh, God. Are we really talking about Escape from L.A.?
Wait. There really is a sequel to this? Not us joking about Captain Ron?
Oh, yeah. And it's insane. But we'll save that for another time.
Yeah, because next episode, we're covering The Thing, and that's way more important.
Agreed. But just to wrap this up, if you love action movies, Escape from New York is required viewing. It changed the game, and Snake Plissken will never stop being cool.
Fine. I'll admit it. Snake deserved to be ripped off.
Damn right he did.
After these messages, we'll be right back.
All right, so we've established that Escape from New York is one of the most influential action movies ever. Snake Plissken is the blueprint for reluctant badasses, and every video game and movie in the last 40 years stole something from it. But what I want to know is, when it came out in 1981, did anyone actually get it? Or was it one of those movies that had to grow on people?
Great question. And I know we've kind of talked about box office already, but it's important.
Oh my God. Again, with the box office, you two love talking about numbers almost as much as you love hearing yourselves talk.
Rude.
Not inaccurate. But look, this stuff matters. If you want to understand why a movie becomes a cult classic, you have to understand where it started.
Sure, but do you even listen to yourselves? You've been talking about how this movie wasn't a hit for like an hour.
Look, man, we get excited. And if Snake Plissken has taught us anything, it's that we don't have to justify ourselves to authority.
Oh, okay. So I'm the government now. I'm Bob Hawke. I'm injecting tiny bombs into your necks to make you talk about Escape from New York. You have 22 hours to break down this movie or you'll explode.
That's honestly not far off from how we operate.
Yeah, pretty much.
Ugh. Fine, get back to the damn box office talk.
Okay, so Escape from New York was made for $6 million, which, like we talked about earlier, is nothing for a movie trying to make a whole dystopian future. It opened on July 10th, 1981, and by the time it finished its run, it made about $25.2 million at the U.S. box office.
Okay, yeah, that's good if you're talking about profits. But that's not blockbuster money.
Exactly. It did well, but it wasn't on the level of something like Raiders of the Lost Ark, which came out the same year and made over $212 million.
Oh, yeah, that's a massive difference. So why didn't this blow up more?
A few reasons. One, this movie is weird. It's not a big action spectacle like Raiders. It's dark, slow-paced, and moody. It's an atmosphere movie. And in 1981, audiences were used to action movies that were faster and flashier.
Right. This isn't Star Wars. This isn't a crowd pleaser. It's just pure Carpenter, which means it's kind of punk rock. It doesn't care if you like it or not.
Unlike you two, who clearly love hearing yourselves talk.
Okay, you're going to roast us all episode, huh?
I have to. Otherwise, you'll just monologue for 20 minutes and I'll die of old age before we move on.
All right, fine. Let's just keep it moving.
All right, so let's sum it up. Not a huge box office hit. Critics were split, but over time it became a cult classic and one of the most influential action movies ever made.
Bingo. Snake didn't win the battle at the box office, but he definitely won the war of influence.
And speaking of Snake winning, let's talk about Escape from L.A. real quick. Because, oh boy, do we need to address that sequel.
Do we have to...
Wait, I know about the sequel. You two keep talking about it, but how bad can it be?
Oh, Steve, you sweet, innocent fool. You have no idea.
It's like if you took Escape from New York, but made every single choice worse.
Come on, it can't be that bad. It's still Snake Plissken.
Oh, just you wait. We have so much to discuss.
All right, before we get to the Hall of Fame induction, I just want to remind everyone that in 3 weeks, we are covering Escape from L.A., and I cannot stress enough how absolutely insane that movie is.
Oh, no. Can we just not?
I'm going to regret this, aren't I?
Oh, you absolutely will, because Escape from L.A. is like, if someone saw Escape from New York and said, you know what this needs? Surfing.
And a CGI tsunami.
Please tell me you're kidding.
I wish I was, but no. Snake Plissken literally surfs on a tsunami with Peter Fonda. And that's not even the most ridiculous thing that happens.
Oh, not even close. Because somehow Escape from L.A. is dumber in every conceivable way. It's like a cartoon parody of the first movie, but played completely straight.
And you know what? The only thing missing from Escape from L.A. is John Spartan and Simon Phoenix showing up to really drive home the fact that this thing is basically Demolition Man's chaotic, unhinged cousin.
I was just about to say, it sounds like Demolition Man, but like without self-awareness.
Exactly. And just to make sure we're all clear, Snake hang glides in this one. Just let that sit with you.
No, I refuse to believe that's real.
Oh, it's real. And we are talking about it. 3 weeks, fellas. Mark your calendars. You're not ready. All right. But before we suffer through that, we've got two absolute bangers coming up. Next week, we're diving into The Thing. Paranoia, body horror, insane practical effects. It's John Carpenter at his absolute best.
Oh, yeah. If Escape from New York made Kurt Russell cool, The Thing made him iconic, one of the greatest horror movies ever made. I cannot wait to break this one down.
Okay, that one I'm actually excited for. I've heard The Thing is next-level horror.
Oh, you are in for a ride. And then, the week after, we are covering one of the greatest cult classics of all time, Big Trouble in Little China.
Jack Burton, baby. Kurt Russell in full comedic action hero mode. The man is playing an action hero who doesn't know he's not the main character, and it's glorious.
So wait, Escape from New York is reluctant badass. The Thing is paranoid badass. And Big Trouble in Little China is idiot badass.
Exactly, and we are covering all of them. Back-to-back Carpenter-Russell greatness.
All right, I'm in. But I swear, if Big Trouble has another CGI tsunami, I'm out.
No CGI tsunami, but it does have a dude inflating like a balloon until he explodes.
I have so many questions.
And all of them will be answered. But this was Escape from New York, a dystopian classic, a cult favorite, and one of the most ripped-off action movies of all time. But more importantly, tonight, we are officially inducting Kurt Russell into the Rewind or Die Action Hero Hall of Fame.
Long overdue, the man defined the reluctant badass archetype. Without him, we don't get Snake Plissken. We don't get Jack Burton. We don't get R.J. McReady. The guy is action movie royalty.
I mean, look, I'm new to this whole Kurt Russell as an action god thing, but after watching this, yeah, I get it. The man commits.
Damn right he does. Whether he's a one-eyed outlaw in a dystopian prison city, a truck driver fighting kung fu wizards, or a paranoid helicopter pilot torching aliens in Antarctica, Kurt Russell just gets it.
And that's what makes him different from a lot of other action stars. He never played the invincible super soldier. He always played guys who were barely getting by, surviving on sheer attitude.
And pettiness, apparently.
Oh, absolutely. If you aren't a little petty, are you really an action hero?
All right, let's make it official. Kurt Russell, welcome to the Rewind or Die Action Hero Hall of Fame. We salute you, sir.
And, I guess I have to watch Big Trouble in Little China now, huh?
Oh, buddy, you have no idea what's coming next.
Wait, before we wrap this up, I just gotta ask, why does Kurt Russell always look like he just rolled out of bed, but somehow that makes him even cooler?
Because that's his superpower. Most action stars train for months to look like a statue carved out of granite. Kurt Russell? He just shrugs, grows his hair out, and somehow becomes the coolest guy in the room.
Exactly. It's effortless. He looks like he's been drinking whiskey since sunrise, hasn't showered in a week, and still, if you put him in a room with 10 other action heroes, he's the only one walking out.
So what you're saying is, I need to stop trying and just lean into looking permanently over it.
Buddy, if you can pull off I don't care energy like Kurt Russell, you can run the world.
Or at least escape from it. That'll do it for this week's episode. Stay weird. Watch movies and don't trust the government. Hey, thanks for listening to Rewind or Die. There's always a new episode every Monday, so don't miss out. Remember to subscribe on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. See you next time. Also, look for our weekly newsletter on Substack.
You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go.
Producer Steve hopes you have enjoyed this program.